Hi everyone, I'm Greg Lowe from Down Under in Australia. Fabric Down Under is a production from SQL Down Under. It covers Microsoft Fabric, a trademark of Microsoft Corporation. Opinions and views expressed in the podcast are individual and don't necessarily reflect the opinions and views of SQL Down Under or of Microsoft Corporation. Introducing Show 11 with guest Andrew Brust. Welcome. Our guest today is Andrew Brust. Andrew is the founder and CEO at Blue Badge Insights and writes about data and analytics. Andrew does independent analyst work at GigaOm. He's a fellow long-term MVP and member of the Microsoft Regional Director Program, and he's co-chair of SQL Server Live and AI Live. So welcome, Andrew.
Thank you, Greg. It's good to be with you. And yeah, we share a lot of that backstory and lineage.
The same backstory for a couple of
really
decades.
Long time.
Yeah, indeed. So listen, for people who aren't across what you're doing and what you're writing, what's your interest, I suppose, from a Fabric perspective? Where does that fit into your world?
Fabric fits very prominently into my world. Again, we kind of share a certain history and lineage around the Microsoft stack. Mine is kind of a combination of the developer stack and the data stack, the data stack now being the more important of those. And as with everybody, you know, AI is important and the data goes right into that. But I've been a Microsoft data guy since literally the first versions of Visual Basic and Access and version 4.2 of SQL Server, which is not the first version of SQL Server, but the first one that actually ran on Windows.
No, indeed. Actually, the earliest I've had running on my machine is 1.1.
There you go. So,
but yes, that was on OS 2. Yep.
And I did go, this was right when I was out of school, to a presentation that was being held by Microsoft Sybase and, of all folks, Ashton Tate, to talk about this forthcoming product that would be called SQL Server. Yeah. So I've been around this stuff for a long time, but what happened is in the late 1990s, because I was a developer. I was a VB developer. And after writing a bunch of applications that kind of did the basic CRUD stuff, you know, putting data up on a screen, updating it, editing it, and so forth, I got very interested in this thing that Microsoft added to SQL Server 7, which at first they were calling OLAP services.
OLAP services,
And I guess a year later that became analysis services, and that became Microsoft's foray into the world of business intelligence, or BI. And that got me, frankly, that got me kind of fascinated, because instead of just writing applications that, you know, created and index the data, I was exposed to things that could take all that data that had accumulated and actually get information and trends out of it. And I thought that was pretty cool. Analysis services back in those days was a completely and exclusively back-end kind of product. We didn't really have BI front ends in those days, but we had object models and we had APIs and we could create our own applications.
And Excel.
Yes, that's right. And Excel. And then, then it got into, you know, mishmashes of Excel and SharePoint and this thing called Excel services and so forth. So I got really interested in the business intelligence stuff, and the small consulting firm that I owned at that time, we started doing BI work. We actually wrote the engine that could do drill down analysis on the results of monthly polls that CIO magazine did back in the day. It even won an award somewhere. But all it was basic OLAP, and we had just built a few dimensions on time, and really the first five questions in each poll were dimensions, like what's your industry, and you know what particular product are you selling, and you could drill down the answers of the other poll questions by those. Anyway, I'm going a little into the weeds there, so let me come back up. That was fascinating. And I got, you know, eventually BI got to be called analytics. It seems to bounce back and forth. But I got very interested in the business of it because I sold my little company to a somewhat bigger one called, back in the day, it was called Citygate Hudson. And then it renamed itself to a number. It became 26 New York.
Interesting.
And we were gold partners with Microsoft with a certification in BI, and I joined the Microsoft BI Partner Advisory Council. And that's really where I learned a lot about how Microsoft could use this technology to advance, you know, its presence in numerous accounts. And it's also where I got exposed to all the competing BI products and not just, you know, sort of buried inside the world of just the Microsoft stack. And I got super interested in, you know, which companies had what and how they competed and how, I don't know, what characterizations were fair and what characterizations were totally unfair. I guess I was naive before that, but that really opened up my eyes to the whole phenomenon of how tech companies compete. And this was back in the early 2000s. So obviously the whole competitive landscape has changed a bunch. And just, you know, to fast forward, I got the opportunity to be the guy covering what we were then calling big data for ZDNet or ZDNet, depending on your audience. I did that for around 10 years. I also worked for in the marketing department of all places for one big data company that's mostly gone now called Datamere. And so I learned some stuff for the vendor side. And, you know, after all that, I just felt like I had a really good grasp of the business and of the technology. Most people in the industry are more on one or the other side of that spectrum. Mm-hmm. I was this oddity who was really interested in both. And that led me to really want to be an industry analyst and talk about this and write long reports on all these platforms and who does what. I don't know, that was self-styled for a while and then it became legitimate. I did a report really on data visualization products for the old GigaOm, and then eventually they hired me on to become their research director for big data. And then GigaOm kind of went away and came back. It left the market, and then its assets were purchased by a completely different company, and it was revived. And I worked as a full-time employee for the first incarnation, and I work for the second incarnation as a contractor, but my team actually heads up all the radar reports. Radars are kind of their versions of like a Gartner Magic Quadrant or a Forrester Wave. All of them that are in the data and analytics realm, we work on those.
That's an awesome background in analyzing the market and where we're at. The thing that I wanted to drill into specifically today was around semantic models and where we are with that. They seem to, again, they've done a bit of name changing along the way. We've had everything from report data models and so on, and semantic data models and semantic model. But regardless, I suppose we should very quickly say, what is a semantic model? And why does that particularly matter now in the days of AI-based systems?
Yeah, so the interesting thing is I would say it matters now more than ever. But in some ways, that's accidental. So what's funny is that when Microsoft first started dabbling with this technology called Power Pivot and added this so-called tabular model to analysis services, it changed its vocabulary from talking about OLAP cubes to suddenly talking about something called the BI semantic model, or BISM. That seemed very pretentious and imprecise. It turns out, actually, maybe it was prophetic because, I don't know, first of all, I'll just be the guy who goes out and says the two things are actually kind of the same. So in the old days, we had OLAP cubes. The word cube was meant to sound like Table, but something that was multidimensional rather than just two-dimensional with rows and columns. It wasn't just tabular, it was multidimensional. And the idea is that you define the numbers you're interested in looking at, the measures, and you define the categories that you're going to drill those measures down by, which are known as dimensions. And dimensions are sometimes flat and they're sometimes hierarchical. And I'm oversimplifying, but essentially that was the cube. In the days of data warehousing, a cube was kind of a conceptual thing that you defined over a bunch of tables that joined together. So each dimension would be in one table and all your in their own tables, and each and all something called the fact table. But when OLAP came out, it actually physically instantiated that. So you actually had a cube. Just like you would actually have a table in a relational database, you had a cube in an OLAP database, and instead of just defining the columns, you find the dimensions and the measures. And then that became rechristened as a semantic model. Now, what then happened as the world of big data came out, which I then became a student of, and also kind of a cranky lecturer within, is everybody forgot about all the OLAP stuff, because it was a new generation of technologists and entrepreneurs, and they looked at OLAP and BI in general and saw it as very old-fashioned for whatever reason. Not really good reasons, but understandable, right? If it's technology that somebody did before you and that you didn't invent, then maybe you wouldn't identify with it. So those things kind of went away, and in effect, all of those measures and dimensions would get defined on the fly at the time of querying the data. And that ends up being really sloppy, because, like, how do you define...
Who'd have thought?
How do you define what products are, and how do you define what revenue is, and how do you define what profit is, mm-hmm. if it's not defined in something like a cube and you're making it up on the fly? The chances of defining it differently from query to query are pretty high. Eventually, that reality hit the so-called modern data stack world, the big data world, over the head, and people said, you know, we should probably have something where we define what our metrics are once and then use it consistently. So then came these things called metric stores, and then somebody else realized, without looking at OLAP cubes, they realize, you know, we should probably also define the other things, the other entities that are important in analysis, which were actually dimensions. And then, I don't know, all of this came to be called a semantic model. And it was, necessity was the mother of invention after amnesia. So everybody forgot the rigor of OLAP, but they realized the need to define things rigorously and consistently. And so, in effect, the big data world reinvented the OLAP world, and here we are back there. And we call them semantic models, just like Microsoft called them semantic models back in whatever year that was, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know, 2010, probably a few years before 2010. So semantic models are ostensibly a BI thing, but it turns out, and... you know, this happens when you architect something well, it turns out it has applications beyond what it was designed for. Mm-hmm. So it turns out that in the world of AI, it's also really important to define all the things that are in the model, because the way large language models work is, if you don't give them a definition, they'll do their darndest to create their own. And, you know, another way of saying that is they hallucinate. They will, like, if you don't give them the answer, they'll make it up. And that's actually not a bug. It's a feature. It's
I think one thing I'd throw in there is that the semantic models tended, to me, it was more than just defining the dimensions and the measures and whatever. The other thing was, it was a layer at which we tended to make things much more human readable, human presentable.
That's fair.
And so on. And hey, turns out that's what the AI systems like too.
Yes. Right? Because the second L in LLM is language. So if you give something that's, you know, I don't mean this literally, because there's more languages than English in the world, but if you define something in plain English, that makes it more navigable for humans. And it also makes it more navigable for language models, because
it's one of the things that fascinates me with that is that I've spent quite a bit of time in recent times with things like fabric mirroring, for example. And one of the issues I have with things like fabric mirroring is that they seem very, very keen on worried about how do I get that transactional data into the model. But yes, they don't seem to spend, to me, the right amount of time on how do I then trigger that to become much more human readable. And there's an awful lot of, it's like every session you go to where they show you direct lake, for example, what they'll do is they'll mirror the data straight in and then start building reports straight over the top of that data. And I think, you know, didn't we spend a decade telling people not to do that?
We did, and then that created a backlash, which is something in my, I turned 60 recently, so something in my old age I've noticed is we go through cycles, and, you know, as a new cycle begins, the practitioners in the new cycle may reject things from the prior one simply because they're from the prior one. But, you know, some things aren't time-based. Some things are just classic, and they make sense in all eras. Yeah. And so what happens is some of the things that get rejected come back. And I would say that happened with the semantic model. But you're right. Nomenclature is a big important part of that. There are these things called business glossaries, and they you know, and to a larger extent, data catalogs that help define that. But the semantic model is a really good place for it, and it's a great place to take tables and columns with funny names and give them, you know, names that are conformed across data sources to just make sense and be, dare I say, self-explanatory.
I would say not even across data sources, even within a single data source.
Even within one, sure.
Getting conformed. Because, so many transactional systems are just invariably not the sort of thing you'd want to build a report on.
That is true, unless it's an operational report and you really want to look at each transactional event. But that's typically not what we want to do in analytics. Although there are definitely folks who would challenge that. That's another story for at least either another day or another part of the show. But if we fast forward now to Power BI and Fabric. So Power BI is actually based on analysis services, as I'm sure you know, and probably a big part of your audience knows. It's the same engine behind it, but it did redefine things. So that BI semantic model got in Power BI got renamed to, wait for it, a data set. Which was a silly decision to make then, but the whole point was, you know, Power BI was self-service BI, so we wanted to let go of overly formal vocabulary and just make it more accessible to non-practitioners. So you had tables, and tables were in data sets. As Fabric has come forward and Power BI became part of Fabric, those got rechristened to semantic models. Yeah. So now we have the semantic models,
which are actually really... when you uploaded a report, it broke it into a report and a report data model as well. Uh-huh. It was part of the naming, but that all has now flipped back across to semantic model. Yep.
Right. But now, as soon as we've corrected the vocabulary, we're actually finding it limiting because a Power BI semantic model, which is, I guess, a Fabric semantic model, is still a Power BI asset. And although those models all by themselves are very helpful with generative and agentic AI relative to not having a model.
Oh, yes.
Right. If you're starting with that as your standard, the BI semantic models look like magic, like manna from heaven. Mm-hmm. But
As they do to humans by comparison. Mm-hmm.
But in the world of AI, we're coming to find out that other things are important too, because BI semantic models just look at the things that are important to kind of aggregational analytics. But BI, but agents should also know about all the things that are operational and transactional. Mm-hmm. So the entities that exist in your operational databases should be in a model too. And by the way, you know, the notion of what something is right at a given moment or what it was last week, that's really important to AI as well. So the whole notion of having temporal reality and having relationships between the entities, not just the hierarchical relationships that we have in BI, but just, you know, peer-to-peer relationships between one entity and another, and the verb that defines that relationship, the things that actually make up graph databases, those are important too. So Microsoft has caught on to this, and they've created a new thing that supports what's supported in a semantic model, but also supports the temporal notion of things, and also supports the kind of graph relationship notion of things, and also defining not just metrics, but operational entities. And they can't call this a semantic model, so they call it an ontology. And so these are still in preview, to my knowledge, but the Fabric ontology, I would argue, is the grown-up version.
Which is part of the branding of Fabric IQ.
Yep. Yes, it is. Thank you for being the branding police, but it's important. So now we have these ontologies, and we're still kind of feeling around in the dark to figure out exactly what those should have in them. But that is an evolution of the BI semantic model into the AI world, and it's not mutually exclusive with it. In fact, you can take a BI semantic model, a Power BI model, a Fabric semantic model, whatever you want to call it, and you can take it and upgrade it to an ontology. Basically push a button and get an ontology that's partially built out based on what you defined in the semantic model. So Microsoft is doing that, and I've just returned from I live in New York City, but I went to San Francisco, and then I came back, and then I went to San Francisco again, and I just got back from that second San Francisco trip to attend the annual summits for two of the larger, I guess, more independent companies in the data and analytics and AI sphere, and that those are Snowflake and Databricks. And both of those companies have been talking a ton about semantics, semantic models, the semantic layer, and ontologies. There's some interesting stuff in there. There's also a lot of just performative rhetoric, honestly, from both of them. That's really true of everybody in the industry, if we're being honest. And, you know, they both have really big expo floors. And the number of exhibitors who slap the word semantic or ontology or context.
No context, that, yeah.
That's sort of the umbrella for all of it. Talk about that in terms of what they're doing. I would say that's the majority of the exhibitors and a majority of the people in the whole ecosystem now. That is the hot, I don't know when the show will air relative to when we're recording it, but right now it is kind of flavor of the month to talk about context. And the reason is that when agents and LLMs have context, they can be much more accurate. Accuracy is super important because you don't want to have incorrect results. But as the subsidies around AI have been rapidly evaporating, and we're getting to the point where people are having huge sticker shock from the bills that they're getting from the AI, from the frontier AI labs, it turns out that context and semantics are actually really important economically too.
Yep. So because number of tokens you send and get back, it matters what you send. Yep.
Well, and the way the agents work and the way the LLMs work is they go trial and error. They go theme and variation. They go iteratively. They try one thing, and if that doesn't work, they try something else. And if that doesn't work, they try something else. And because we're setting this whole world up to be self-service, where anyone can create an agent to do everything with very little governance and very little control, we're unleashing this, to use the term of art, swarm of agents that are going nuts querying our analytical databases and using tokens every time they do it. So if we can just bring that from a world of chaos to something grounded in having semantic information at the disposal of the models so that they ask intelligent questions and don't ask so many of them and don't ask them so many different ways and so many different times, guess what? We're going to save money. And so that's a big motivator too. And by the way, there are companies in this space that are focused just on the semantic layer.
Yeah, I was going to say ontologies have been around for, again, quite a period, not just a thing that appeared with Fabric. One of the things that does trouble me with some of the things Microsoft does at times is they tend to take terminology that's already used in the industry for one thing and then sort of reuse it for something else, you know. That's endlessly frustrating to me. It's like ever since I first dealt with their term, technology. I mean, I look back at the very first time I saw Windows and it had a default gateway, and I thought, you know, like, I mean, router was a perfectly good word and gateway was a perfectly good word, and that wasn't a gateway. You know, that was a router, you know. But anyway, but the thing is, yeah, they just kind of redefine words. One of the things that they've chopped and changed a lot over the years is the terminology around entities and attributes and properties and fields and things like that. One of the things that surprised me when I was looking at Fabric IQ in some detail, but note that, again, they've used entities as the different objects, and I mean, yeah, I'm cool with that. But normally when you talk about entities, you then talk about attributes of the entity. And curiously, they went with properties. And then I started trying to talk to one of the product group members about, so what's the difference between an attribute and a property? And that got into a really quite bizarre discussion on how he thought maybe both would end up existing and so on. And so, again, just even the terminology of those things really quite puzzles me. But
yeah, I mean, the problem is
he was saying there might be sub properties, you know, or something that he was thinking were attributes. And I was like, oh my goodness. Yeah. So anyway, so yeah, I don't know. And in terms of terminology, but I think the bigger thing to me, it's okay to be able to say, I define entities and I define the relationships between them. But what completely seems to be missing to me is what you were talking about earlier, the equivalent of metrics or things like that. Or, you know, there's no concept of, okay, well, when I say top 10 customers, what do I mean by top, you know, and so on. Or, you know, any of the measures that I want to deal with, it's really quite bizarre that you can't just define those things once, again, at the ontology level in IQ. And I struggle to see how you make solid use of it without being able to define that level of stuff as well. I don't know. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, some of these model facilities do let you define that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in advance of anything to do with generative AI and Fabric ontologies, Power BI had this thing where you could define synonyms and where you could define terms so that you could disambiguate the very kinds of things that you're talking about.
Actually, it's interesting that Q&A,
yes,
they've
exactly
deprecated, what's right. It, December this year. And it's really sad to me because I have a number of clients who really, really like Q&A. But again, the thing is you could define, yes, not just synonyms, but linguistic aspects and, you know, all sorts of things. It was actually quite clever.
It was, and I advocated I guess, in vain for them not to deprecate it, or at least if they were going to re-implement how it was sort of done and where it was stored, to at least keep the interface, because a lot of people got used to it and invested in it, and it did promote a certain kind of discipline, a linguistic discipline around how you worked with data. And that's exactly what we need in the world of agentic and generative AI. And the interface for defining that stuff was actually pretty good. And they even actually had kind of Copilot technology behind the scenes to discover some of that and auto-populate it and then let you edit it. So it's not like that stuff was completely dissociated from modern AI. But because it was conceived in a time before AI, where it was just more about, linguistic and, the kind of stuff that you do in RDF, to define ontological things having nothing to do with AI, because it was a product of that prior era, it kind of got cut, and I'm sorry that happened, but I think what we can see is that we've been hovering around a lot of these questions for a long time. We've taken different approaches to them. So I just got back from the Databricks Summit, and one of the things, so they're using, for most of their agentic stuff, they're using the brand Genie. Originally, Genie was just their natural language query mechanism for using AI to do BI kinds of things. But now Genie is a family.
Yeah, and it wasn't too bad, actually. I've been doing a bit of Databricks stuff again lately. And yeah, the Genie code window, you can open up and just ask it how to write things, particularly if you're working in a notebook or something like that. You could say, hey, I need to write a query that does X, Y, Z, and it'd just write it for you. It was quite powerful, actually.
Yeah, so now Genie is to Databricks, kind of like Copilot is to Microsoft. It's more of a brand and less of a particular product. And so they introduced this thing that, wait for it, they're calling it Genie Ontology.
There you go.
But it's got some interesting things, because in addition to what we might put in a semantic model and, the extended things around temporal and graph relationships, what they're saying it's going to do is to auto extract entities, relationships, and what they're calling expertise, just by looking at the tables and documents and chats and applications that you build. They're going to try and discern stuff kind of through osmosis and put it in the model. And they're introducing something of a ranking system to deal with ambiguous situations and disambiguate things. So in the world of Google search, right, there's this thing called PageRank. That's a big algorithm. So Databricks is introducing something called OntoRank. So it's the PageRank analog to Ontology rather than web search. And we'll see. There's been a lot of speculation for now going on a few years that Databricks will have an initial public offering at any moment. And usually before you do that, you want to be able to tell a story of how you have a very broad platform. It certainly felt like they were telling a story of a very broad platform at this conference. I mean, they have this thing called Genie One, which is your agentic coworker. They have something called the Unity AI Gateway, just to use the G word that you were talking about, which will act as a single kind of access point for all of your MCP services, and also route things to particular models based on, I guess, certain cost heuristics. This is all still kind of I don't want to say vapor, but, you know, kind of ether. Also something called Omnigent, which is a meta harness for a number of different coding agents and regular agents. So I likened it a little bit to the old days of instant messaging, where there was this company called Trillion that gave you one UI over a bunch of different instant messaging clients. But it's not just a UI unification. The idea is to set up different agents to do different things, and then to be good at the particular parts of development, and then to come to Omnigent with a big prompt that says, I want to build this. And then it would ostensibly delegate certain subtasks of that work to different coding agents. Anyway, this is, that should at least impress you that they're trying to build out a pretty broad platform and narrative. They also announced a real-time technology called Lakehouse RT. And oddly, they kind of talked about how no one before who has tried to build out hybrid OLAP and OLTP has been successful, and then they announced that they're doing it. So they are, Gartner coined the phrase HTAP for hybrid transactional analytical processing. And so Databricks is calling theirs LTAP, where the L stands for lake. So we have lake transactional analytical processing. So they are really staking out a lot of territory.
It's interesting. It's as I said, I've been working through a lot of stuff with some Databricks systems lately, and it's sort of an interesting thing when you spend time working in Fabric and I spend time working in Databricks, and it often sort of feels like the same thing with a different interface in lots of areas of it. And I just sort of wonder how that plays out for Microsoft longer term. I mean, and I suppose it doesn't worry them. I mean, you know, they have different databases available in Azure and so on. So the idea of having Databricks there and Fabric there, but it is a significant overlap between the two. And but even there, you can see Microsoft's done a lot of enhancements to Databricks to make it play nicely in Azure as well. So that's a lot of effort they're having to put in two different areas there. But I suppose they get shared learnings between them.
Well, yeah, but I mean, Databricks is actually a competitor to Microsoft, despite the fact that Azure Databricks is ostensibly and officially a first-party service.
Mm-hmm.
They are competitors, but they also work cooperatively. So one of the things announced is that Databricks but will if be you, able to
one
use...
One thing I'd throw in, though, note that Microsoft has released even certification for Azure Databricks.
Sure. Sure.
Which is not, you know, we don't see Microsoft releasing a Postgres or an Oracle certification.
Hi, this is Greg coming to you from another time and place. If you have a data-related project that needs to get off to a great start with the right architecture, or if you have an existing project that's off the rails, why not contact us? We help organizations of all sizes, from startups to tier one financials, and we can help you too. Check us out at sqldownunder.com.
You know, you have these things in Unity catalog called metric views. You have the Genie ontology. And then, by the way, there's a whole initiative that Snowflake has been driving called OSI, the Open Semantic Interchange, which has become a consortium of a great number of vendors, including Databricks, actually. And the idea here is that since everybody's kind of building out their own semantic models, there ought to be a kind of neutral language so that you can really kind of convert one to the other or get one to read the semantic information that's in another. I think that's honestly more rhetorical than it is, you know, absolutely implemented. And I think a lot of the vendors that are in there because they want to be part of the semantic layer discussion, even if it's not necessarily something core to what they're doing. But it's an interesting phenomenon that OSI exists, and many, many vendors, I think more than 30, have joined it now. So the world is definitely semantic, ontological, and context crazy right now.
So where do you think Fabric IQ is at? Are we at the usable stage yet, or are we still a distance off?
Well, first of all, we have to define what it really is, which, mm-hmm. you know, as far as I can tell, like the ontology is a big part of it, and the data agent and the operation agents are big parts of it. And then the...
Although those, the build... those operation and data agents are almost standalone things that can be associated with it. Yeah.
Well, that's right. So in some ways, it's an umbrella brand for a bunch of things. But
yeah,
even if it's branding and brand engineering now, I do think it will be fleshed out to be more concrete than that in terms of technology and platform. But the idea also is that anything that's kind of published in Fabric IQ should be visible in the Work IQ context, so that if you're using Copilot and you want to be able to talk to have your AI talk to your data and to all of your documents or all of the things that have surfaced in Teams, et cetera, that should all be able to happen together. So the M365 Copilot can be informed by what comes out of Fabric IQ. And that is already, you know, tangible. There is the ability to do that, even, again, if some of it is really branding and it's really about what the data agents are exposing to the outside world.
I found when I looked through it, it felt still incredibly green to me. And to give green? You a simple example, yeah, like really yeah. Early.
New, fresh.
I mean, a simple example is that they've documented the fact you can't have an entity named words like product, for example. Okay. And you just go, pardon? Like, I mean, that makes no sense to me. But then it turns out that they said you can't have an entity called product because that's a key word in GraphQL. And I'm like, oh, wow. A lot of these things feel very early days to me. I can't imagine, you know, what's the chance of wanting to have an entity called product is pretty high, really.
I would say it's almost 100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting thing. I mean, the good thing about Fabric is that it took so many separate Azure services and brought them together, right? It defragmented a lot of the stack. The tougher part of that is that in Fabric you do have so many engines. So I hadn't even thought about GraphQL, but you know, we have the Lakehouse engine, we have the Warehouse engine, we now have Azure SQL effectively as SQL databases. We also have the technology that was in Azure Data Explorer, codenamed Kusto, which shows up as event houses, which has its own query language called KQL. There's a lot of engines to work with. And if we're going to, you kind of expose all of it in some semantic way, I can imagine there will be some reserved words that feel unnatural.
It was just interesting to me that it's just an indication that the way they're doing parsing inside the code is, let's say, early days.
The things that Microsoft does used to embarrass me, because I was like, oh, Microsoft, how can you do that? But then as I became an industry analyst and looked at lots and lots of companies, they all do it.
It's nothing new. One of the things that I always thought with Fabric, it's interesting you mention all the different engines, but I think one of the opportunities that was sort of missed when doing Fabric is bringing a consistency to how you work with all the different services. I mean, where we had all the different Azure services, that's one thing, but And I still often use all of those as separate services. But the thing is, every one of them, you know, it'll be, I don't know, the name of objects. This one takes underscores. This one takes dashes. This one's case sensitive. This one's not, you know, and so on and so on and so on. And I kept saying to the Fabric people, one of the key things they could have done was had like something that worked cleanly right across all those different services somehow, you know, because it'd be a bit like, you know, imagine if you had Microsoft 365 or Office or whatever, and you had different rules for, you know, the file names in all the, you know, and so on and so on. It would just be a bizarre thing to do. And I think to me, that's one of the things that Fabric could have been, is something that sort of removed the complexity of dealing with everything being different in the different services. And whereas at the moment, it still a bit feels to me like a single interface into those services, but you've still got the restrictions of the services themselves.
I would argue that kind of unification has to come in waves, and they've already abstracted some of the complexity away. In terms of UI, in terms of procurement, in terms of manageability and provisioning, at least that has become more equalized. And the capacity model, although it's sometimes criticized because it's not, you know, it's not purely pay as you go. The capacity model really helps because it says just pay for a pool of usage and it's fungible across all these different engines. Whereas before you needed to be paying for each one and they didn't even bill on the same basis. So I don't know. Rome wasn't built in a day. Fabric cannot defragment the stack in a day. But I think we'll see iterations where it becomes more rational. And you know as well as I do, probably better than I do, that this is a side effect of how Microsoft works, which is that different product teams are encouraged to work independently and competitively, and everybody does their best. And the idea is that that internal competitiveness will result in stronger products, because through Darwinism, the best one wins and you have a great outcome. But in fact, what it means is you have lots of things that can't be rationalized that then have to be.
It's not that aspect, the Darwinism thing. That's really quite interesting, because I spent a lot of time in the 80s working with HP, and in the, let's say, the heyday of the industry, the better years for HP. But the thing that was interesting is that the Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard, both of them, I know when they were around, they actually loved the idea that three different people at different desks were working on the same thing, because they just thought they'd end up with a better thing.
Right.
You know, and it was just interesting that every other company I was dealing with at the time would see that as a waste, having separate groups working concurrently on the same thing.
Yep. And it is a waste. But I think there's also merit to the argument that competition makes for better aggregate outcomes. But it can be real rough on the product marketing folks who have to take all these separate things and rationalize and put one brand over them. That's what Azure was at the beginning.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it was all those different groups working on services. Yeah, go ahead.
I was doing a webinar a little while ago, and it was an interesting thing. One of the attendees commented, he wondered why Microsoft was rebuilding Azure in Fabric. And I thought that was a sort of fascinating comment. But anyway,
first of all, I think there's something to that, and I believe that it's intentional. Because the Fabric people believe very strongly in the SaaS model and software as a service, and find that there is a lot of downside to the platform as a service PaaS model. Mm-hmm. And so, in fact, a lot of the PaaS entities in Azure have been recast in the SaaS model on, and you know, it's not called Azure Fabric, it's called Microsoft Fabric. And I know for a fact by talking to leadership, people in leadership roles, that that was very intentional, that the Microsoft brand has a different kind of, I don't know, appeal and halo to it. And Azure appears more to, you know, engineers and technologists, and that the idea with Fabric is we want the total addressable market to go beyond that. So it's not accidental.
Hey, listen, so that pretty much brings it up to time, Andrew. The what have you got coming up? Where will people see you or hear from you or anything?
Well, I feel like, gosh, I just got home from being at a million different events, but I guess the next big one for me will be when we do Live 360 in Orlando, where I will be co-chairing Data Platform Live and Artificial Intelligence Live. And of course, Visual Studio Live will be there too. That's arguably the flagship. So that will be in November in Orlando, Florida. I don't
it's a lot better weather in Orlando in November, at least.
It's a little less muggy in the winter months. It can be kind of pleasant, dare I say.
I've had some mighty warm events in Orlando over the years. Yeah, it's all good.
Lots of them.
So
a
listen,
lot of tech ads and such.
Yes, indeed. So listen, thank you so very much for your time today, Andrew.
It was my pleasure. I hope we can do it again before, I don't know, at a shorter interval.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.